Welcome to the 76th episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck, where we revisit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. My name is Kalen Egan.
My name is Travis Sintel, and boy oh boy, do we have a guest for you today. Self-proclaimed, and also I will proclaim, best guest of our podcast. That's what we have said.
We'll see. I mean, yeah. We say that about every guest.
There's the fierce debate.
Yeah.
You know, I think...
We tend to introduce every guest telling them that they're the best guest, yeah, and then they
shrivel
and collapse under the pressure. Yeah. I think you might stand up to it.
I have zero fucks to give, and I'm here to prove it to you that validate my own statement.
Can I explore a theory?
Yeah.
Are you the first guest we've ever had who's never heard this show?
He is.
This is why I think you're right.
I've never listened to the show, but I look forward to it. It sounds like a good premise. I think you guys should do more of them.
Yeah, this is great. So let me tell you how this came about. So Evan and I are old Facebook friends, in-person friends.
Yeah.
And we were having breakfast today. Kalen and I had set this podcast time a while ago for today. And I said, Evan, you know, we're having breakfast. You know a lot about film. You're a writer-producer. Come be on our podcast. He said, yes, sight unseen. I don't know what the podcast is.
Pretty accommodating, right? Like, yeah. Like almost I could say yes to anything.
It was great. It was very hard to get. I actually went to his assistant to book him. But we made it
My
happen.
Second assistant.
Yeah.
Julie.
Yeah. There was a phalanx of assistants to fight through.
Uh-huh.
And I also think it happened to work out given the...
Well, I don't want Evan to feel sandbagged. That's the one thing I want to be sure about.
Please don't sandbag.
On some level... Yeah. Maybe you should have been told what you were getting into a little bit, but maybe not. Maybe it's better this way.
Is there more that I haven't been told, like that you're going to reveal to me?
No, just the movie.
Oh, just the movie.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Uh-oh. But I want to be clear that these happen independently.
No, yeah, part of the thing about this show is we respond to the moment, baby. Like whatever's happening in the world, whatever's happening in our life, that sort of feeds into the show. And we've been very lucky, I think, that based on our polls and whatever is happening in that moment of time, things tend to come together.
Oh,
so
the stars are aligned. I hope that's
the other thing that is important for our viewers, our listeners, to know about Evan is...
Well, a number of things. Yeah. Besides being a writer-producer, Evan, tell us how you make your living.
Yeah, so I've somehow fallen into this...
Not somehow.
I never had the intention of pursuing this as a career path. It started off in college as just a way to pick up women back in 1997. I'm 38 years old.
I'm also 38.
And my friend Alex, who I just saw Black Panther with this morning, he said to me, he's a director in Hollywood, and he said to me, you really sound like Tom Cruise, just naturally. You have his like natural, you know, mannerisms and his inclinations and intonations and all that. And Jerry Maguire just came out like a few years prior, maybe 1 year before we went to college, and we were 18 years old, and he does a Jean-Claude Van Damme impression. And we basically...
That's a very specific impression.
And it was very funny, actually. I wish I could do it as good as he can do it, but I can do Tom Cruise. So anyway, he says to me, let's tag team each other, do a little routine, and meet women this way and knock on dorm room doors this way. And we did.
This is how it started. Wait, you would knock on a door and be like, hey, I'm Tom Cruise, that's Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Well, it was much more elaborate than that. Right, but, you know.
Can we do a little play act here? So, Travis and I are a couple of dorm girls. Here you come knocking at the door. Hello.
So I would say, so what's your name?
Brandy.
Brandy. You don't know what it's like to be out here. For you. It is an up at dawn, pride swallowing siege that I can never fully tell you about. So just help me help you, Brandy. Help me help you. Help me help you. You see this coat I'm wearing? I don't need any more. You know why? Because I'm cloaked in failure. I had two slices of bad pizza. In the morning, I grew a conscience, Ray. Woo! The fucking zoo's closed, Ray. The fucking zoo's closed. You know, Brandy, one thing I've learned these 4 years, sometimes you just gotta say, what the fuck? Make your move.
I just recast our situation. Now you're Jean-Claude Van Damme. What do you say?
I have too many questions. Wait. So
70% of the time it worked and the doors opened and we had a nice night.
70%?
30% of the time that, you know, the door was slammed in our face.
Wait. Did they ever call security? Like, honest question.
I mean, we had the RA, you know, so it wasn't
like... you gotta stop banging on these freshman girls' doors and yelling.
Yeah, I think we maybe had someone scold us once, but...
Once?
Yeah, we got away with murder back then, and I did frat parties. I did it for fun back then. I didn't think about even in the slightest remote possibility of doing it as a career. But I was an actor growing up. Like I've been acting professionally since I was 7 years old. But I still never ever would think that I could do this as a career. And then YouTube came about, so it was like 2004, 2005, whenever it started. And my girlfriend at the time said, just kind of nudged me, put up a video, see what happens. Like, I didn't have a wig and glasses, just pure acting. So I didn't rely on what I basically hide behind these days. I wear a wig and glasses for my impression because I'm not a lookalike. So, and I've kind of fallen into like his eccentricity. So I try to like channel the Risky Business, Top Gun, old school Tom Cruise that the people really love and remember. And it's Mission Impossible too. And, but back then I had nothing. I was very naked without it. But I still managed to do a good enough job that it got me a bunch of work. And the first video, so that first video had a couple hundred thousand hits, which was a lot back then because there was no marketing push. There was no Google AdSense.
It just went
viral
on its own.
It just went viral on its own. I kind of cornered the market early on. And then there was Funny or Die that came about. And again, I was like first one out of the gate after the Landlord video that came out.
Pearl. I remember Pearl.
I put out a video called Tom Cruise is a Cock Block with my with my co-conspirators, Richie Keene, who's like a big Hollywood director these days. He did Fist Fight, and he does a lot of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Talented guy. And then my friends Ross Kahn and Eddie, they co-wrote it, and it was like a little phenomenon, like a little YouTube, a little web video phenomenon back then.
Great.
I really sound like an old man, like a web video.
Way back when.
So the internet, the W, you know. Yeah. So we had a great time with that, and then from that moment on, I kind of worked pretty regularly. I mean, there's definitely dry spells I've had, but it's Tom Cruise has indirectly saved my life many times in terms of getting out of debt. Because my career is as a producer, but as an independent producer without a trust fund, it's really difficult. And I'm usually waiting on this lawyer, this actor, this management company to get back to me. So there's a lot of downtime and just, you know, pulling my hair out. And I need to find other ways to fill it. And Tom Cruise is one of those ways. And
so it's been great. Detailed or personal, what is the mechanism by which you're like, God damn, got to fill the coffers. I got to go do Tom Cruise. Is there a circuit that you can run, or is there kind of...
Well, I mean, I guess the impersonator business is kind of not aloof to people, but there's a lot of questions people have. It's very surreal. It's very weird. People usually jump to, oh, you do conferences, you do things like that. I actually don't do impersonator conferences at all, although there are big, that's a big world. I actually just get hired for commercial work, film work, TV work. I do live events now all over the world. I mean, I haven't been all over, but I've been to New Zealand and London, and I represent like pharmaceutical companies. And so I'm not the unethical, you know, jobs I take on, but it's a lot of money. And I do tech companies are big now. You know, I represent like their sales force, and like I boost morale within the organization. And
all I'm imagining is
I do couch jumping.
You do like male self help groups, and where you're trying to sell them.
I say respect the cock and tame the cunt. If you were to seduce and destroy today for $39.95, she can wet your duck.
Jesus Christ,
amazing!
I did not know so much of that. This is all like
I mean, there's so much more. I mean, I'm actually writing a little mini memoir about it because I've had outrageous stories like. I won't get into, because I know we have a show to do, but basically...
This is the show. Let's be very clear.
We're pivoting right now. I have a new interest.
But I have some hilarious stories where, like, there's this... I won't name any names, but there's, like, a rival impersonator there who has kind of come after me, and I don't even know the guy, and, like, I have nothing against him. He just has something against me, and he's... I've met him. I won't even say anything, but he's not from here. But he's been in LA because he's worked a little bit as well.
It's Tommy Wiseau.
It's Tommy Wiseau. But he ran into my girlfriend at Alfred's Coffee. I was there, but I didn't want to confront him because I don't want to have a confrontation with the guy. I knew about him. I knew that he was already talking shit about me.
Is he sniping at your work, like your impersonation?
He thinks I'm, or he's said that I'm like I steal material. Which couldn't be further from the truth.
Tom Cruise?
Yeah, like basically that's what he's saying, which is outrageous because I'm doing parody of Tom Cruise. Yeah. Obviously, I'm lifting from his. But the truth is that I do a lot of improv. I actually broaden his universe. Like the reason why I've made such a career out of doing the Tom Cruise impersonation is because Tom Cruise himself is such a secretive person that I am the window into his world, into this surreal, crazy Terry Gilliam-esque world. That's fascinating. Like, I create this outrageous spectacle. I do the most ridiculous things with him because I can, because no one knows what Tom Cruise's life really is like. I love, you know?
It. Yeah. That's incredible.
So I fill so that smart. Void yeah. for people's imaginations.
You know what's so funny, so just as a very minor sidebar to this, is yeah. around the era you're talking about in the sort of mid-2000s, I think Eve was, you may remember this or know this. Is there something wrong?
I'm just checking the battery.
In like 2007 or 2008, maybe 2006, something like that, like one of the first things that my wife did when she moved to LA was this series of internet viral videos oh. as Katie Holmes.
Oh, really?
Where she was doing, yeah, so she was doing these sort of Katie Holmes videos.
Because I had been looking for a dedicated Katie Holmes, you know.
Yeah, yeah, well.
That's funny. Well, she's taken now.
This close.
Yeah, yeah, no, but back then that would have been great to know.
Yeah, because
what's her name?
Eve Sturgis. So she put on, I mean, the videos are still up, but she put on dark sunglasses, put on a wig, and just did
I mean,
Katie
I might
Holmes.
Have very well been familiar with her work.
Could be.
Yeah.
She only did a few videos, but it was, but that.
So I just wanted to finish. Wait, no, finish what
yeah,
you said.
Yeah, that's it. It's just like how funny. So, a lot of that was similar to yeah. what you were just talking about in terms of filling out the life, because it was sort of, there's a secrecy to their marriage and Scientology and
right.
whatever else. She would sort of, that was the comedy skit, basically.
So this guy confronted my girlfriend outside of Alfred's, or I think my girlfriend actually approached him and she was trying to get some information, be like, oh, I recognize you from somewhere. Do you do Tom Cruise impersonations? And he says, yeah, I do other things too, but that's what I do. You know, he was a little standoffish about her, a little defensive. And then he says, well, what about you? And she was like, well, my boyfriend actually does impression. Immediately when she said that, he went off on me. To her.
Live. Just in
to my face. Girlfriend, Jesus just talking Christ. Shit to my girlfriend about me.
That's weird.
So he's already, and then several weeks later, he checked out, I guess, some of my work more thoroughly or went deeper. Down the rabbit hole of my hundreds of videos online, and he wrote me an email, not mentioning any of the, not apologizing for anything, because, like, of course he knew that I would find out from my girlfriend what yeah. he'd said, but he just basically said, like, you know, I respect your work, and cheers, mate, and all this stuff, and I obviously didn't respond to him, because I'm like, fuck this guy, but I've never once thought anything bad about the guy or even said anything bad about the guy, but he has like this grudge against
there's
me.
There's so much to unpack.
It's the grudge part
stories.
Five, you know.
I can't deal with all the threads
but,
I want to follow.
But right. I also have
my head's falling off.
I mean I don't like to ever really I do mostly an homage to Tom Cruise. I don't really do any like, you know, speculative stuff or any gossipy things, you know, but I have delved into or made certain remarks about Scientology before.
Right.
And there I had a scare back when I was living in Franklin Village, which is the Church of Scientology oh, yeah. Celebrity Center across from me, where I absolutely thought I was being followed or tracked by the church.
Oh my god.
Yeah, in several ways. I mean, it's probably a story off podcasting or whatever.
Yeah, so let's get into
off
it.
Off the record.
I did a.
But I want to tell you something crazy after we're done.
I can't wait to hear that.
Listeners, you yeah. can fuck right off because we're getting the real deal. I did a show for CNN about Scientology, and I got calls.
Yeah, I'm 100% on their radar on a list of some sort. And
yeah, they have
but
my
I think
number.
I think you know that old adage where it's like, you know, keep your friends close but your enemies closer.
Yeah,
they've tried to recruit me several times.
But yeah. Tom Cruise is aware of you. He knows.
Oh
of
yeah,
your
very much aware of me. But the one time I met him, he was incredibly nice to me. But I don't really know how he feels about me. I just know right. that he was very nice to me, made me feel like $1 million. But you know, that's you know, I don't know what's real and what's not in this world.
Sure.
Let alone Tom Cruise.
Who does?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think. Go on, you
I was going to move into
yeah,
the
I mean,
new
same,
thing.
Same. So I was going to say that I think it's important for the listeners to note that this is a confluence.
You're really milking this thing.
Well, I think it's important to understand.
They get it. They get it. We're watching Jerry Maguire, Evan.
Are you serious?
Yeah, we're doing Jerry
That's
Maguire.
What we
Oh, my God.
This just happened.
Wait, so this is so funny. This
so
is
this
perfect.
Idea of nostalgia, yeah. which is how we were sort of setting yeah. the show up, is
wow.
I had no
I'm
idea
so
it was actually this relevant to,
yeah,
in terms
yeah.
of your
I didn't either, but
origin
here's,
story.
But here's
I really hope I still like it. I mean, yeah. that would be terrible.
Well,
this is
thing.
What it's all about.
This wow. is what I want. And
what a good segue.
One of the things that we've been doing for guests is people with an expertise in an area. And I have been thinking a lot about this poll in terms of Tom Cruise's current relevance, and I'd like to talk a second about this before we watch the film, in terms of what's happened in his career, where he's been, where he's going, and what happens to him in 5 years. I'm very obsessed by this, especially after watching The Mummy.
Oh yeah, the next 5 years are going to be really crucial.
What happens to him so in 5 years from now?
Correct, that's what I'm saying.
Well, he's already starting to get injured a lot.
Yes.
There's right. already been two injuries.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the next thing that's going to happen. He's going to realize that you know, unless he they find a good body double and they do a big cover up, he's not going to be continuing these stunts for much longer.
Why did he do that? So we see that.
Why did he do that?
Well, no, I mean, why? So his career path is very interesting to me. He obviously has acting chops.
Right.
This guy is an incredible, to me, I'm just
He made a boatload of money off Mission Impossible 1, and he was like, this is my career.
Isn't it a money grab? Isn't it a money grab then? Is that
Absolutely, because he was the producer on that first one, so he made so much money, he was like, this is another way to not only have more money, but also be in bigger, more control. It's about control, it's about power.
You think it's a power thing?
Absolutely.
So after Magnolia and all these the movies, I wonder...
Well, Magnolia, I think the reason why he hasn't done anything since then of that caliber of acting and performance is because he didn't win, and he should have won. He was fantastic in that movie. And he's like, why should I put in this much energy again to try to win this award when I can make so much money and just please the audiences? He's all about the fans. He's all about the audience.
I peg it to Last Samurai, too. I think that was, it seems like a career turning point to him.
That was another one, where he was like, you know what? Fuck it. If I can't please any, I can't please the Academy, then I'm just going to please the fans.
So does he just retire at 60? Like, does he keep...
Well, no way. Will he not be a leading man anymore, you're saying? Will he just be an old man working in film?
What does he do? Like, what are the roles he does?
Well, here's the thing. He's entirely capable of any... I mean, I'm here...
Expendables 12. He'll do Expendables 12.
5 years is a really interesting marker because in five years, you're right, he's going to have to become a new kind of a character, a new kind of actor. And I wonder, and this is totally unfair and totally probably wrong to even speculate about, I wonder if we're coming to the point where Scientology becomes an issue for him and the rejection of Scientology offers him a new trajectory in life and career. Because
is that actually happening or is that a rumor?
No, I have no idea if it is. I just sort of think that this sort of the way that his career has been going. I mean, here's my theory about Tom Cruise, and you're the perfect guy to run this by and tell me what you think, or we can discuss.
Well, I actually have a major theory that you'll be fascinated by because it's technology. It's rooted in technology.
Oh, I can't.
But mine's very simplistic. It's that Tom Cruise he suffers or is enabled by fame. He's been famous his whole life,
like a Michael Jackson syndrome,
precisely. Mm-hmm. Elvis. I mean, he's famous more. Famous than anyone can imagine.
He doesn't know what it's like to not be.
He does not know, and he has an institution that is dedicated to preventing
him from knowing. To preserving that.
That there's anything weird about his lifestyle. Like, I have this conversation all the time, which is like, do you think Tom Cruise is sad? And I'm like, fuck no. Not even a
little
bit.
He's in a bubble of happiness and contentment.
He has no idea what sad is.
Right.
He's consistently and perfectly elevated. He may be on some deep level sort of existentially lonely, but probably not even really that.
Right.
And so, fundamentally, what he has managed to exhibit, and the reason he is such a valuable movie star, and I see him as one of the most, if not the most valuable living movie stars as far as what he can do, is he's play pretend. He's Mr. Play Pretend. He's the best pretender in the history of movie making. And that is a different thing to me than acting, which he can also do. But when you talk about his dedication to Mission Impossible, I think it's like he's fucking Ethan Hunt. He's on the adventure. He's living this out. And because his reality is constructed in this very bubble-like way, it's an extremely easy transition for him to be like, I'm a fucking spy. I'm a super spy.
Yeah.
I jump on this helicopter. I'm banging around. Right. Like, there's a very thin membrane between reality and fiction for Tom Cruise.
Well,
and this is
a lot
an
of
asset.
Actors. We've seen that in a lot of other actors also.
I think nobody like this.
No one's that level, but the thing you're describing is something with precedent that I understand, which is interesting to me.
Have you guys heard of the Futurological Congress or the Congress, the movie?
No. Oh, the Congress. Yeah.
So it's based on the Futurological Congress, which was a Stanislaw Lem book.
Right.
Who did Solaris. Right? Right. So I was in that with Robin Wright. I played Tom Cruise.
Wow.
So half of it's live action, half of it's
animated,
right? And my scene was with Robin Wright. And Robin Wright plays herself, and the whole movie's about, do you know what it's about?
No.
You're going to love this. So it's about the digitization, full digitization of the essence and vitality of the youthful stars in our cinema. So it's basically Robin Wright is approached by the studio system, like Paramount, but it's called Marymount Studios, and they try to give her an offer she can't refuse, which she initially refuses, but then the call to the adventure, she takes the offer, which is to basically digitize her so that everyone will see her. She'll never have to act again. She'll get paid a boatload of money, and forever and ever and ever, everyone will see her in movies, digitally remastered, as Princess Bride and Forrest Gump.
Wow.
Never Robin Wright from anything later, because that's her golden years.
Right.
And Tom Cruise is one of the last actors to sign the contract. Every actor in Hollywood has signed up. Johnny Depp, everybody, right? But Tom Cruise is the last one to fully... So it's basically this, like, motion capture thing, but that totally digitizes every single aspect of you so that they can, they don't need actors anymore.
Right.
And that's, that I think is the future.
That is crazy.
So well, that, that's, I think the future of Tom Cruise is to preserve, to fully monetize, just like how, what Disney has done with Star Wars. They're going to make Star Wars forever. Same thing with actors. They're going to capture the essence of that actor and never need them again. And for all of time, they're going to give us what, what, give us our nostalgia forever. They're going to preserve our nostalgia.
Right, right, right. Yeah. What a perfect concept and idea.
Yeah.
Before it's Ready Player One, you know?
Yeah, totally. Before all that, I think that we're going to find Tom Cruise becoming an actor again. I mean, that's the next thing that'll happen.
I think,
I hope so.
Me too. I really hope
I hope he does.
And by the way,
he won't work with Paul Thomas Anderson again because of The Master, I don't think, but.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I love the Mission Impossible movies, increasingly so. I think that the 4 and 5 were probably my favorite.
Maybe the first one. They're incredible. The 4 and 5
are fantastic.
He has made very few bad films.
It's true.
Very few.
I saw on the subject of bad Tom Cruise films.
Yeah.
Night and Day.
Well, I don't know about Night and Day, but I watched The Mummy, and then I watched recently. I watched like 2 nights ago. I watched.
I haven't even seen that.
American Made.
Oh.
And that was super interesting too, in terms of where his career trajectory. Did you see that?
I didn't see it.
So where his career trajectory? It's very fascinating because it's not a. In both cases, The Mummy and American Made, not good roles for him. Like they're just not. They don't suit any version of him. They don't suit the sort of cavalier kind of go for broke action star. The Mummy is all sorts of broken and bad.
Yeah,
it's one of the worst movies I've seen in a very long time. but and he's horrible in it. But it's not his fault because like the whole movie's horrible.
Yeah.
American Made. He shouldn't be in, but it's the most interesting commentary on his persona in the world because he is doing, as an older guy, not old, but like older, no question, he's doing everything that's familiar about Tom Cruise, but in service of a character who's an idiot. Like, that's the function of the movie. The point of the movie is this guy's so dumb. It's like he's playing an Owen Wilson part, but he's applying everything about Tom Cruise's essence to that role. And it's pretty cool.
That's fascinating.
It's like kind of fucked up.
That's kind of what I liked about this. Is a sidetrack, but I liked about Ozark was watching Jason Bateman apply his bag of tricks to a dramatic character, and you're seeing quirky comedy.
Well, that was one of the best pilots I've ever seen.
I thought that was cool that he did that. I thought that was such a neat thing to see his essence in the service of a different goal.
Yeah.
But that I haven't seen.
I loved Edge of Tomorrow in terms of recent Tom Cruise movies. That was a great movie. He's great in it.
It's great.
He was very funny.
Yeah, and American Made is Doug Liman too. So like,
I think they're a good team.
They are a good team.
I agree with that.
And they have interesting stuff to do. So.
One other thing I want to say about this.
Okay.
Just in terms of our podcast, I was thinking about it. You'd be hard pressed to find a movie star that's around today that is equivalent or rival to Tom Cruise in certain ways. I think he is because he's so emblematic of certain decades of American culture and the way he's tapped into certain movements in terms of masculinity, in terms of stardom, in terms of pop culture as a thing, and he's come out. Okay, like there's obviously crazy Scientology things we've heard about and all these different scenarios, but just Tom Cruise as a representative of our culture starting in the 80s is really fascinating to me.
Yes,
because you look at him in Outsiders, right, and tracking his career from there, he is the, if you think about the 80s or 90s, there's images that will come up, and Tom Cruise is in a lot of those images, just in my head. He is part of American culture in a weirdly inextricable way, and I find that fascinating. And I don't know of anyone else who does that.
He's an incredible chronicler of our history in some ways since he began.
Yeah, he's like Madonna or the Beatles, you know. But,
And this is the first time. Yeah. It's funny.
He's reinvented himself.
Right.
Many times,
and he's proven himself to be capable of. You know, he is the ultimate movie star because he's always Tom Cruise, but he's always adaptable to any given or many different given scenarios, whether that's super action star, whether
he's impressed
drama,
me many times,
whether it's comedy, you know,
Interview with the Vampire.
Exactly, I forgot about that.
Like even movies that are kind of campy or whatever, he created a great character.
But he's always Tom Cruise. Yes. It's fucking fascinating.
But he's still but Brando. Brando always had Brando in himself.
Yeah, that's true.
Because even when he played Caesar, he was still Brando.
That's true.
You know?
That's true. But
they're movie stars, but they're great actors.
They're movie
too.
Stars. And that's a thing that's gone away essentially completely. I mean, the last, maybe you would count, I essentially count, there's Tom Cruise and there's Denzel Washington, and those are the last living movie stars. Mm. Maybe there's George Clooney, but not really.
Do you put Will Smith in there or no?
We've talked about it.
Well, Will Smith, yes. Yes, I would. But I think
what do you think of like someone like Tom Hardy?
No way.
He's
not even close
star.
To a movie star. Hmm. Not even close.
Yeah, this came up on.
Yeah, you're probably right about that.
Yeah,
on great Black actor, too, but probably not. Yeah, not a.
Yeah, no, and Tom and the thing that I'm most excited about with this movie Jerry Maguire is this is essentially right in the middle. This is right in the middle of Tom Cruise's trajectory. I know that it's sort of on the early side given the years, but like this is post-80s heartthrob. This is post-Risky Business. It's after all the Cocktails, after all that stuff, but it's trading on all that, and this is him turning into a man, basically. It's turning into a dramatic actor. I mean, he did a few
things.
This was
Tom Hanks' Philadelphia.
Yeah, totally. You know? But it's Tom Cruise style, so it's not actually... issue based on any level. It's about him.
I wonder, did Cameron Crowe write this for him? Because it's perfect for him. It was perfect.
I think he wrote it for Tom Hanks.
Is that right?
Yeah, I'm fairly really? Certain. Yeah, I think that's the true thing.
Well, and so all of that said, and what you said is super interesting to me about this being him, his career and the films he's been being a sort of cultural milestones, is that this is going to be an extremely different movie in 2018 than it was in 1995 or whatever it was when it came out, 96.
I can't wait. I'm so excited.
It's going to be so different. And the thing,
I can't contain it.
And I saw this movie, unlike most of the movies that we pull out of this bag, I've seen this movie in the last few years.
Someone actually pulled this. No.
Yeah, I did.
You pulled this and I'm here today.
That's what I'm saying. This is what we're talking about. That's why Cam was annoyed. I was being so careful with it, but I have a history on this podcast of people accusing me of lying.
You couldn't have a more perfect... more handsome, best guest in the history of this podcast.
So you're saying you are the best
absolutely.
Guest.
The stars right are absolutely aligned. Factual. But I want to say one more thing before we begin. I'm actually working, again, with the synergy or the stars aligned. I'm working with Jonathan Lipnicki now. We found each other through Instagram. We DM'd each other. He's buff now. He does Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He's
fucking amazing.
And he's a really nice guy. And we're doing a Top Gun 2 sketch, like a parody of the homoerotic volleyball sequence.
How did this all come together like this?
I posted we have some mutual friends, and I posted something about, you know, because obviously I do my impression. I posted something involving my impression, and he wrote, "Daddy?" and then he instant messaged me.
He's funny. That's good.
Yeah, he's funny. And he instant messaged me, and he basically said, he made my day. He was like, "Let's do a sketch together." He just doesn't want to do Jerry Maguire because he wants to kind of be removed from that.
Of course.
Because he's a very talented actor. He did some really funny sketches after that. And then he's now writing a book too. And he's a talented guy.
The last time I saw Jonathan Lipnicki come up on my radar, I want to say he was like listed as in the understudy cast for like a Martin McDonagh play or something in LA. And I was like, fuck, like this guy, or maybe it wasn't McDonagh, but it was something like that. It was something really high quality. And I was like, whoa, this guy, I was so impressed that he was looking to transcend any kind of old iconography and just do his due diligence as an actor. I was like, fuck yeah.
And I've never told him this. I've been, you know, hung out with him a few times and like prepping this project. We're going to shoot in a few weeks. I actually think, because I didn't want to, like, you know, when you meet someone you admire, you don't maybe tell them how awesome they are.
Right.
But I think he, even though the movie we're going about to see is so good on many levels, or at least how I remember it, but I think he stole the show in many ways.
Well, he became part of the cultural conversation. Yeah. The human head weighs 8 pounds is like we couldn't. You get a coffee without someone saying
I can't imagine the film without him.
I agree. Two questions before we go into this. I know we're running out of time. So you've seen it in the last 5 years.
Yeah, this is what I was going to bring up now. So the other part of what we want to do is sort of what we're expecting the film to be, given what we saw it before. Okay. So for me, I saw it a number of years ago. I was doing a whole Cameron Crowe run. Yeah. And part of the reason I was doing that, because I'd become very... I mean, what Cameron Crowe has become is a whole other subject to conversation that I hope to get into after we see the film. But I was watching these movies because I had seen like Aloha had come out or whatever. Oh, yeah. And I was watching Aloha being like, what the fuck with this guy?
Well, he had some missteps, of course. That one and then the one before.
Well, the one before Elizabeth. Orlando Bloom, which is totally insane. Yeah, and I was like, what happened? Like, was this guy always horrible and now time has caught up? He's like, was that one of these guys where it's like, we just never noticed how bad he was and only now in the incongruity? So I went back to watch some of the other movies, including Jerry Maguire.
Singles.
And I didn't watch Singles, but I did watch Vanilla Sky. I watched Jerry Maguire. I watched... recently I watched Almost Famous to see all... So I saw and I have thoughts on Cameron Crowe now.
Interesting.
And I have big thoughts on the way that a movie can be so of its time and important in that regard, and then in the intervening years, later years, it takes on a whole nother status, a whole nother purpose or reason to be. But when I watched it, I thought it was fucking amazing. I thought it was a great movie, but maybe not the way it was a great movie in 1996. And so that's going to be a big part of this conversation, I think.
What do you think of? When's the last time you saw it, and then what do you think
it's
gonna...
been a few years. I mean, I wouldn't say I regularly watched it every year since it came out, but I definitely have seen it multiple times, like at least 10 times. I don't know. But
when's the most recent, though?
Yeah. Years. I can't give you an exact date, but probably 5 years.
Okay. So it may
be different. So, like I said, I'm very excited to see it again. I'm so glad this is the choice for today.
Well, and I would challenge you, Evan, to watch this, given everything. I mean, this is all going to come
with fresh eyes.
With fresh eyes, as if none of this, you know, try to sort of remove yourself from the life that
this created for you. It's going to be really hard because it means so much to me, especially this film in particular, because it really did start me off on my...
Well, I would love to hear you talk about the feeling of that when you watch this.
Well, I wonder if the emotional quotient is still as strong as it once was, because I remember when I first saw it, I was totally wrapped up in it.
Right.
Whether it was manipulative, like a Mr. Holland's Opus or not, like it totally got me.
Yeah, totally got me.
And I think Cameron Crowe does that really well. And of course, his use of music is amazing.
Yeah,
I think he's right up there with Tarantino. Like, you know,
yeah.
Well, here, just as a teaser, what I expect
Bob Dylan, The Who.
Yeah,
you know?
I try not to talk. I would like to not.
I'm open-minded.
Make this sort of the subject of the series that we're doing. This podcast, but it happens more often than not. And I just want to say what I'm. Sometimes we do this. I want to say what I'm a little worried about, but which I sort of am. I'm thinking that I won't be able to resist talking about is what I found interesting about watching this again recently in all of his movies was Cameron Crowe to me is telling a certain story about maleness and whiteness that is a different story now, especially now. I mean, this moment right now.
This is the Jay Moore is the boss guy,
the asshole.
Isn't there a white black athlete thing that happens in this movie?
There's Cuba Gooding Jr.
No, I know that, but I'm saying there's a conflict. You might know this, but isn't there some indication that he's treating the white player different or picks?
Well,
white
I mean, Jerry like, O'Connell's the other guy.
Jerry O'Connell. That's
right.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And he's but a quarterback.
Well, it has not. I don't think it has anything to do with race. I mean, we'll see it, of course. Okay. Maybe I'll have a different interpretation. But
I know you know this.
He was more into Jerry O'Connell because Jerry O'Connell was a better value as an agent to represent this guy.
I'm not saying this, but this just spurred my memory of a specific issue that I had forgotten about. No, I'm interested in that.
But are you implying that there might be like some underlining reason why he may have sided with Jerry O'Connell over
I remember that being a thing.
Cuba? I think people could draw that conclusion, but I don't see that. I just see him as a more valuable prospect because Cuba, even though he has the potential, hadn't proven himself, and he was a bigger risk.
Yeah, okay.
But that's text of the film.
I want to say this. The only thing I remember about this film, learning about this film, is that... So my friend did a comedy class with Cuba Gooding Jr.'s sister, and he came to see this thing, and I learned this story... and he apocryphal. I don't know if it's true or not, but apparently Cuba Gooding Jr.'s father was kicked off the set of Jerry Maguire because he went up to Tom Cruise and said, "Hey, it's nice to meet you. Are you gay or what?"
Wow, I think I've heard that too.
And they said, "You got to get off the set," and he was asked to leave the set.
Wow,
so
that's pretty wild.
There you go. Some factoids about Jerry Maguire.
You know, I've never heard that perspective before, though. About maybe not that this was a racist move, but just that there was a race issue in this. I've never heard that before.
That's just Travis remembering, so it could be bullshit.
Well, you can talk about whatever you want. That's not at all. I'm talking about how the culture will respond or responded, and how we will respond to Jerry Maguire.
Like if it had come out today,
yes,
you're saying
yes.
Okay.
That's just issues. I'm sorry.
Well, we're in a very sensitive society right now. Where
that's what I'm talking about.
Where anything. it will raise an issue, especially with social media. Anything will at least be some... Yeah. Whether the community of people debating it is 10 people, there will be 10 people debating it.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if it's possible to watch this movie, and we're going to find out, Jerry Maguire, and I don't think we should resist it if it happens, in the Me Too era. Basically.
You know what people did debate this movie about, why it was provocative? The one thing I distinctly remember was that, he wasn't really in love with her. The ending was bullshit. That was the biggest thing that everyone, especially females... fought against. They railed against it.
Yeah, I wonder.
Men loved it.
Do you think that will hold up as an actual emotional screenplay?
I have a little look. Anything's possible in the world of romance and love. Anything's possible. So I suspended my disbelief and just went with it. And I believe their performances. So you know what? Some people have screwed up crazy romances in their life. You know, this could be one of them.
Right. One last question for you, Evan, and then we'll just go watch the movie. This is not about Jerry Maguire. How much, in your opinion, has doing Tom Cruise reforged your personal mannerisms and personality?
Well, it's funny. I like to think of Tom Cruise, this persona, as like an alter ego.
Yeah.
It's absolutely an alter ego. It's like Jekyll and Hyde to some degree. It's like Batman and Bruce Wayne. I'm actually a neurotic Jew from New York. Yeah. I'm very neurotic. So if I were to, like, I kind of was thinking the only way to take this even further, my impression, was to do kind of a hybrid of like Larry David and Tom Cruise, or like Paul Reiser or Woody Allen, because I'm extraordinarily neurotic, and I've been a little tamed through the years because my girlfriend is from Hawaii and she's slowed down, but that's who I am truly deep down. I'm an Italian Jew.
So do you, sense of alter egos, do you, you know, you're a producer, you say, yeah, do you call upon your sort of Tom Cruise sauce in order to go and do have a great meeting on some level?
To have
a great meeting or whatever?
Sure, absolutely. Like, I always ask, instead of what would Jesus do, what would Tom Cruise do? and it helps me get through many situations, sure.
Unbelievable.
Well, because he really is from just meeting him that one time, like, an incredibly unique individual with a very high frequency vibration. If you believe in any of that stuff,
yeah,
he really is on another plane of existence.
I don't doubt it. He seems the most charismatic.
And when he talks to you, like, I've never heard a story. I've heard like one possibly negative story about him. Everyone who's come into his presence has been just completely swept up in his energy.
Yeah,
and just feeling like $1 million. Like I was saying, VIP treatment. Laser focused. There could be the most important person in the room next to you, but he will treat you like you're the most important person.
That. That's so fucking.
It's
awesome.
Really cool.
Let's go subject ourselves to this dynamic energy.
Let's get in there.
Well, don't worry. Don't worry. I'm not gonna do what you all think I'm gonna do, which is just flip out. Well, let me just say, as I ease out of the office I helped build, I'm sorry, but it's a fact that there is such a thing as manners. A way of treating people. These fish have manners. These fish have manners. In fact, they're coming with me. I'm starting a new company, and the fish will come with me. You can call me sentimental. The fish, they're coming with me. Come on, come on. New company. We're going to a new company. Okay. If anybody else wants to come with me, this moment will be the moment of something real and fun and inspiring in this God-forsaken business, and we will do it together. Who's coming with me? Who's coming with me? Who's coming with me? Who's coming with me besides Flipper here? This is embarrassing.
We going?
We did it.
I want to set the table a little bit.
Yeah.
One of the things that we do a lot, Evan, when we're watching movies, we don't always watch the movies together, but sometimes we do.
Oh, okay.
And when we do, there's a sense where we sort of try not to influence each other's
sure.
watch or whatever. We want to keep it like live for the thing.
Sure.
But inevitably, you can't help but read your audience that you're with, and mm-hmm. everybody, and sort of, so Travis and I sort of will try to combat this, but then we'll come in and we'll say like, okay, well, I noticed you doing this during the film.
You heard me cry a little bit?
Oh, I didn't, but that's okay. That's fine. But reading the room, here's my theory,
yeah.
Go
which
for
may or may not bear out.
Oh, this is
my
an
theory.
Interesting idea to start. Okay,
please.
It's my theory.
Right. Yeah.
Cast your judgments.
I think we all loved the movie.
Yes.
I think we all loved the movie.
Yes.
But I would bet you $1 million we loved it for extremely different reasons.
Okay, that's very possible.
And maybe okay. not three different reasons,
yeah.
but at least a few different
reasons. I'd love to hear
angles.
Your reasons.
I think we loved it in three different ways.
Okay, that's
great.
That's better.
I want to go
better.
Through every reason
much
why
better.
We love this movie yeah. individually.
yeah, that said, as a sort of starting point for the conversation, I want to start
You don't think
with,
there's any overlap?
Well, there's plenty of
okay.
overlap, I'm
okay.
sure. But I want to start with you, not necessarily what specifically you loved about the movie, but feel free. But just
sure.
sort of any
first
takeaway,
sure.
yeah, coming out of it.
Well, Well, I was certainly holding back the full flood of emotions and tears between two men I just met. I was like, where are the Kleenexes? They don't offer anything in here. Uh-huh. I was hiding it, but probably not that well. But I guess you didn't hear it. I was trying to be discreet about it.
That's great.
But yeah, I mean, look, it still got me. It still struck a chord. And whether it's manipulative or not, like I think I talked about Mr. Holland's Opus as like the epitome of manipulative cinema, in my mm-hmm. opinion.
I agree with you. It's the only movie I've ever walked out of.
But right, but
you walked out on it because it was too manipulative?
I just was like, stop doing this to me.
I get it. That was a really, really sad movie. But this That's movie, hilarious. Look, it worked. It whatever he does, it fucking works. It got me many times. The first time it really got me in the movie was when he hugged Ray, and you had the close-in shot of Renee Zellweger seeing that there's this love, that this void, you know, after her husband died. And it just got me from that moment on. And then the connective tissue of emotion was definitely Ray for me. And that's why I still have that theory that they say in the film, she says, you love my kid, but you kind of like me, and I'm not built that way. Right. So it does back up. It's a very complicated relationship they have, though. Yes. And I get why people are so skeptical of their feelings towards one another, because they have a very tenuous relationship, and it's built on, it's a marriage of convenience completely. Mm-hmm. But I think in the end, he does want to share this joy with her. And the whole movie, the reason why I liked it, my real takeaway is that it's really a David and Goliath story, us against the world. Everyone thinks he's a fucking joke. She's the one person who believes in him. It's aspirational. You get behind him the entire journey. He's got that one fucking client. We all want, at least for me, I can't speak for everybody, but I do believe that this is a universal thing where we all strive to have that one moment in our lives where we take that risk and it pays off. Mm. Yeah, and that's right. Exactly what this movie does brilliantly. And I wonder, you said that he was a sports agent, Cameron Crowe, is that right?
No, I just wonder how much time he spent with them.
Oh, okay.
Studying it?
Yeah.
Remind me a lot of entertainment agents, so the same deal. Yeah, sure. I mean, these guys work at CAA.
Because I feel like that this whole story is like what agents who are working their really miserable lives wish they could experience at one point in their life where all the bullshit, everyone is against them, and they just take that one chance and it pays off, and they're like, fuck everybody. Mm-hmm. And then everyone mm-hmm. comes to them and is like, I want you to manage me and handle me. I don't want to be with the old system. I want to be right. with the new system.
You've right. basically done it, but can we summarize
That's why I love the film, because it hits me on an emotional level where it's totally aspirational. I don't, again, know if I buy the romance, but I do think that there's a lot of poignant scenes where they have great chemistry. The first makeout scene was really terrific.
Wait. I love what you're doing. I want you to keep doing it.
I go off in tangents.
I love it. Will you summarize the film for us as you do this? Because you're doing it.
I'm a stream of consciousness. I love it. I can summarize
it for you. But keep going, because do what you're doing. So I'm loving what you're saying about this. But
you want like an IMDb summary?
What do you mean? As you go, so the audience can, you know, Ray is the kid's name, and basically the story about Tom Cruise, who's a sports agent.
Yeah, so he's a sports agent who has for many years just been a cog in the wheel. He might have built this agency with some people, and he's very successful, but he's just part of like this bullshit machine, and he's recognized that over the years as the sports industry and entertainment industry the same way has gotten so, it's all about capitalism, it's all about the money, the dollars, and it's the heart is missing. The real love of the game, you know, why we started to do this in the first place. And I'm like getting emotional. I actually got emotional.
Yes.
Oh my God. No, because it really,
I wanted you to do this. Guys, Evan's crying a little
now,
bit.
It might be because I'm so connected to this film and to Tom Cruise in general.
Please don't forget to talk about that, but because I'm so interested in that.
Look, that obviously plays a role, that obviously plays a part, but it really speaks to me because it's like, it's just the human condition. There's so much bullshit, and we're all trying to wade through it and navigate through all the bullshit. And he does it. He does it successfully in this film, but it's a long, arduous journey. It's a huge struggle. There's so many blocks in the way, but it's his own ego. It's a movie about the destruction of an ego and finding the love again for the game, for why he's doing this. Why is he doing this? Why does he wake up every morning? Is he happy with what he's doing? And we all go through that. And that's I think that's why it's a successful film. That's why it struck a chord with America and maybe some global audiences.
Yeah, yeah. And then he writes a manifesto.
Oh, right.
Yeah, look, what I'll sets show, it I'll off. Do, no, the yeah. first act to the second act, the main thing is he writes his manifesto. Everyone fake loves it. You know, they all think it's brilliant, but then he gets fired the next day. And now he has to rebuild his life from one client. And the only one who joins him, who's just like enamored with him, is Dorothy Boyd, who is an accountant in his office. And she goes on this journey with him where they're just crossing their fingers the whole time and rolling the dice.
You did it. That's it.
That's it. Yeah, sorry.
That's the movie. No, that's it. That's perfect. Yeah. I mean, that's it.
I gloss over things, but I was macro and you're micro.
No, it's great. And then they fall in love, and then that's
yeah, but I, you know, the falling in love part is really question. It's a big question. Mm. But like, who knows if they stay together after that? But they definitely had a bond at the end. I just don't know. It was such a weird romance, you know. Yeah.
I do like that part about it quite a bit, actually. The weirdness of the romance, especially for the time period the movie's made, is really intriguing.
I think there's an honesty and authenticity to it. Like, it's definitely not Hollywood. It's definitely very, I mean, the ending was Hollywood with the big grand entrance where I'm looking for my wife. And I love the ending so much, not just because of the speech he gives, but because in terms of writing as a screenwriter, he concocted and created. And it wasn't just the end. He created this women's group who pretty much hates men, very negative towards men, okay? As the final place where he has to win her over, which is the hardest challenge of all. Mm. But it's total honesty, and he does it. Mm. It was just amazing.
So tell me, before we move off of your reading,
you almost
film,
got me again.
Yes. I just want to know.
I love it.
Maybe I don't mean for this to be an emotional trigger, but what? So what about it? Watching it sort of now with the last 20 years of your life and sort of how that's grown and how this film has how does it age for you now on the purely personal
it's not without its faults. It has its schmaltzy moments, but again, like, it totally works for me. It's very inspirational still to this day. I want to go out and fucking write. I want to do something contrarian.
Yeah.
I want to do something that I want to buy when there's blood in the streets. I want to buy Bitcoin right now, you know? Like, I'm just...
That's the takeaway?
No, I'm not thinking about money, but I'm just thinking of an analogy or allegory, but...
But who's created a career out of this, you know, if this, which we didn't know when we came into this, if this film is at the inception point of what has become the last 15 years of your life or more or whatever, what are those kind of emotional resonances or nostalgic, like, what are those nostalgic feelings, I guess, or are they complicated? Is there sort of a do you have to, I guess what I'm asking is, does this movie make you kind of reflect in some way on your own life?
Just, absolutely,
because I mean, you were, even it was look, happening I'm, while we watched the film, Evan is very natural at stepping right into the pattern of the language.
Yeah,
he knows the lines, not every time, but like, I bet you could do a good quarter of the film
sure. This is probably the most quotable film I do. There's a lot of
clearly
great lines.
I mean, oh my god,
there really are a lot of it's really quotable lines. Unbelievable. In this movie,
and he delivers the shit out of
and also what I love about this movie, by the way, is that it's the last one of the last times I've seen Tom Cruise really vulnerable and showing just honest, raw moments, like him crying at the end with Rod. That I don't think I've seen him do those performances. I mean, other than Magnolia, in a very long time.
I will say, it was surprising to me. I was actually shocked. So Tom Cruise spends, I would say, 20% of the film with that Tom Cruise intense stare where his eyes are red, like he's kind of crying a little bit. He has that.
20% is high.
No, maybe 25%. Like,
I love statistics. Like, where do you come up with statistics?
It's crazy. I just kept registering how much he was doing that thing where his eyes were watering and he was intense.
Sure.
And I just thought, I don't see this Tom Cruise anymore.
No.
I see the intensity of the stare when he's about to kill someone or like fight someone.
Right. Well, he's very self-aware and aware of his like best camera angles now and like how does he want to be perceived. Mm. I feel like in this movie, I don't know if Cameron had something to do with this, or he just was, you know, just more open. He just had this vulnerability that's shown through.
You know what I think it is? You know what I think we've lost from Tom Cruise's performances, and he may do this again, but it reminds me of this era, what he's coming out of, which was, I'm thinking specifically of like Rain Man, Born on the 4th of July, this film, Magnolia. Mm-hmm. those characters are sort of prototypical 80s characters in that they are caught up. It's like Charlie Sheen and Wall Street. It's like they're sort of caught in the rat race. They're in the money game, and they're all going through these extreme existential crises of who am I? I mean, the reason I point at Wall Street is because literally Charlie Sheen has this ridiculous line where he looks out at New York and he goes, who am I? Mm-hmm. But basically that's what these characters are. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be rooted in a very 80s, capitalistic, character. And what's amazing about what we were talking about before, as far as who Tom Cruise is, what is his connection to humanity? How deep does that go? How much has he been sheltered? I don't know that he necessarily wants to explore that question. It doesn't seem to me that the parts he's picking are existential.
For sure. And there's not a lot of depth.
What I'm amazed about, and this is perhaps this is a transition into sort of my read of the film, which is very different from yours.
That is a beautiful screensaver, by the way.
It's not bad. Thank you. I designed it.
Go on.
He has no idea who he is as a human being. From basically, he accidentally cracks open humanity, and it's suddenly all around him, and he realizes how vacant he is. Mm-hmm. And what I think is incredible about the film is he never gets there. Mm-hmm. He has no idea who he is.
Even by the end,
he is longing to be a person,
totally,
and he never really gets there. And there's a lot that I love about the movie, but that I think just as a creation of a character and a performance, it seems to me to be transparently true. I know I don't know that for a fact, but watching the film, I don't see... It's hard to distinguish between the actor and the character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, also, it's a weirdly transgressive ending to me. It plays as a Hollywood ending.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
but,
boy.
But because we just saw him see this thing that he now wants, and he goes and does the thing that he just saw, if you're watching it with, like, eyes open...
It's a cycle.
You go, oh, okay, cool, so he hasn't gotten anywhere. He's ending where he started. But, and yet... I still got kind of like emotional because it's
how could you not, man?
It's pulling the strings in the right way. Well, I'm not saying it's disingenuous.
I don't think it's pulling those strings.
I'm using the wrong phrase for that, but I think that it's doing the things that are real, and I think that Tom Cruise's character believes that what he's saying in the moment is true.
Yeah.
100%.
Absolutely.
But we as the audience go, well, that's going to go away.
Well, the movie is so, you pointed it out, this scene with a big debate that we're going to have on some level, debate, whatever, is about his relationship with the kid and how that factors. And you were talking about that moment as being the first time.
Look, I might be wrong about the line.
Forget about it. Forget about being wrong. Nobody's going to be wrong. Nobody's wrong.
Yeah.
But you pointed out that scene as the first one that gets you, where it pushes in on Renee Zellweger when he's hugging.
Right.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I think wildly different point of view. Mm. I felt deeply emotional because you could see her becoming lost. Mm. You could see her cracking for a bad idea.
Right.
That made me very, very emotional. And you watch that. I found that myself. And I didn't remember this in the intro.
Well, you know what's coming, though. So, like, now... No. So, in this time, well, seeing it versus the first time.
Maybe so, but Bonnie Hunt's fucking telling you how to feel.
And Bonnie Hunt is definitely
and
telling you
how
to feel.
And she's right. 100%. Bonnie Hunt plays her older sister, who knows from the very beginning...
total skeptic.
...that everything that is about to happen is a bad idea.
Right.
And she's right.
Because you get the impression she's been through it herself. Yeah.
Maybe.
She's worldwide.
Well, the movie is always... able to do this. It does it with Cuba Gooding Jr. in the most amazing way, where he has insight that Jerry Maguire doesn't have. Bonnie Hunt has insight, and they're both watching these two characters who are a bit clueless.
Yeah.
And so that scene played to me, and I think it happened in the scene as opposed to my knowledge of where the story goes. And partly, I would have to say that this movie is resonant and powerful for me because I dated and fell in love with and married a single mother. Mm. And I have a personal point of view on all that. Mm-hmm. What I found this time watching the movie, most fundamentally, is everyone else is watching this movie. Mm. And the other characters, the peripheral characters, are watching this movie.
Yes.
And they all have an angle on it. And it's all not what any traditional Hollywood romance movie. It's not Jerry Maguire's movie. Mm-hmm. I think that all the characters actually watching it are saying, this is Renee Zellweger's movie, and he doesn't know he's in it. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me to be the rooting emotional drive of the entire film, is he's trying to understand his place in this story. He thinks it's his story and it isn't. At least for me, that was the angle I took watching the film. And the movie is very, very clear and very fascinating in how it sets up each individual scene in terms of its subjective point of view.
But you it's know, not called Dorothy Boyd. It's called Jerry Maguire.
Well, because he's the biggest thing in her life.
Right,
he's
right,
the
right.
big. He's the focus of.
You're right.
Of the
hey,
subject.
Listen. It's a very sound interpretation. I like.
Well, it's and it doesn't yeah. always do this, but it's yeah. its facility with point mm-hmm. of view is incredible. Mm-hmm.
Very very.
But it's able to tell. I think three or four maybe different films in one, and it's a lot about who you are and what you bring to it, and the fact that it ends on such a to me, fundamentally, this is a good thing, unsatisfying mm-hmm. couple of notes, mm-hmm. which is unresolved, makes it feel utterly realistic, like deeply,
totally.
Crazily realistic.
And in that structure, I mean, mm-hmm. the inciting incident is not necessarily the memo or the mission statement. It's kind of her agreeing to go with him.
Right.
That's yeah. kind of the inciting incident in the film in a structural way.
Especially if it's her story.
Well, I'm saying either way, I think, right. in a way, because if she doesn't go with him, who knows what he does? Like, I don't
right.
know if he does the same thing that he ended up doing. And I'm not saying that she supported or created his business for him, but I do think
right.
that is what the structure of the movie indicates.
No,
that
she's the reminder of a whim. And the struggle of the film, which he didn't know he was doing, is, should I live up to that? Self-ideal
yeah.
of myself, of fantasy
the
ideal.
The guy I was one night drunk that this woman fell
exactly,
for.
Which
yeah.
is not who I am.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't know that, but it isn't. It fucking mm-hmm. obviously isn't. He's
yeah.
a vacant, shallow dude. Like,
and the movie doesn't spend any time re-encapsulating that memo and making him the kind of person who wrote
that
memo.
He keeps trying to deny it.
Yeah.
He keeps being like, please stop talking about that. That's mm-hmm. not helpful to me right now.
Which is
like,
great screenwriting, I think.
Oh,
the
yeah.
fact that
well,
he's
that's
trying
the
to
thing.
Suppress
so,
the thing that made her fall in love with him.
Do you know what movie this reminded me most of in terms of what we've watched on this show is, well, do you know?
Mm.
It's Chasing Amy.
Uh-huh.
In the sense that this is and I went into that with extreme skepticism. And the
you
same.
You've never seen Chasing Amy?
Oh, I'd seen it. I'd
oh,
seen
you
it. But
okay.
I hadn't seen it in
right.
20 years.
Right, got it.
And I went into that being like, I am really worried about this movie because mm-hmm. of its gender politics, its sexual politics,
sure.
it's all this, you know, the gay straight thing, and
mm-hmm.
is this
looks a lot like Renee Zellweger.
That's true. And is this a movie about, you know, turning a gay girl straight or whatever? Like, I watched it and I thought all of that went away because it has this extreme depth of honesty of story.
Well, you nailed it with the depth. There's certainly a thoughtfulness with both of those films that I think
yeah.
is intrinsic throughout. Chasing Amy, I absolutely adore.
Yeah.
But because it's so thoughtful, there's so much examination
yeah.
of the roles that we all play in society and our just various relationships with one another. And
well, and they're both movies critically.
But it does remind me of this in a way.
Yeah,
it really does.
There's a couple
key scenes.
Even more so,
yeah.
yes. Even mm-hmm. more so because that movie has this amazing scene,
yeah.
which I think everybody... Not everybody, but a lot. The reason it was popular,
yeah.
and I would propose perhaps the reason this movie is popular, is because people are identifying with the protagonist. They're identifying with Ben Affleck and Chasing Amy. They're identifying with Jerry Maguire in this film.
Mm-hmm.
But both of them have scenes where I think they're monsters,
mm-hmm.
and yet it's presented from a certain point of view
sure.
as a romantic gesture, and you see the girl make a bad call.
Yeah,
and they both have this moment
yeah.
which feels sort of. Like it plays by the rules of romance, but is a horrible idea, which
right.
is then the rest of the film. Like,
well, I mean, we all can agree that a lot of relationships start from a premature place.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But they haven't really thought it through.
No, certainly
it's just
not.
Emotionally
that,
based.
It's a desperate act.
Desperate,
this is the
yeah.
start of a desperate act.
And this
act.
All comes from desperation. This whole movie comes
exactly.
from desperation.
Exactly. Right. Chasing
people who need
have.
To fill a space in mm. their life, and they're looking for any opportunity, and they're falling in
yeah.
love with that opportunity. And I just, that's what breaks my heart about that scene where he's hugging the boy. He's
yeah.
not even, by the way, in that
yeah.
scene, not even interested in the boy. He's
yeah.
sort of like, oh, this is weird. This kid's kissing me. I don't
right.
really get it or like it. And she is locking on the back of his head.
Mm-hmm. But it's her reaction that got me. Yeah.
What this looks like, a man who's down with my son.
It wasn't their moment that got me as much as her reaction to it that really got me.
Well, but yeah. and to me, it gets me because I'm like, oh,
yeah, don't do that.
Oh, no.
I know.
And it's Bonnie
I know.
Hunt is literally there telling you that that's
right.
a way to feel. And in
right.
most movies, she's a joke. In most movies, she's the naggy sort of pessimist who's gonna
who's
be fucking proven
past,
wrong.
Well,
yeah.
she
and
represents
who's cave emotionally.
Yes.
Never happens.
Bonnie Hunt though represents all the friends in my life who have told me, "Don't go for that girl. You're gonna make a mistake. Don't do it." And of course, I do it because I want to learn my own mistakes.
Right.
And I really think, you know, I just want to live my life and experience it myself.
In most movies,
you
though,
know?
Keelan's right that love would conquer that woman.
Right.
And in this movie, she is correct.
Yeah,
you know, for the most part,
I think she's correct to the last. And the the sort of, but all of that said, there is such, I feel such pathos and feeling for an emotion for them trying, even though they don't know how to do it, that I love them all. I love the frailty and fragility and failure of every character in the movie.
Even the jazz guy.
Yeah. I want to say something possibly contentious. So
I love it.
I think that what I'm intrigued by from this movie is that it seems to me to be a series of screenwriting and performance and linguistic shortcuts and shorthands that compose a film. And let me explain, because I know that sounds very negative, but I don't necessarily...
Yes, I don't know what at all what you mean.
So there are a series of things... Same. Yeah, there are a series of things that the turns happen very, very quickly. They don't feel earned at every point. Mm-hmm. The lines that sound very good aren't always earned to get to the lines that are quippy. And Cameron Crowe is very agile and deft with linguistics in certain lines. They're very rarely earned. However... Every actor in this film is dialing up a performance really high, in my opinion. And it's almost tends towards hyper-reality in a lot of areas where the performances are so coming in so hot and so large that it makes these shortcuts work in a weird way.
Well, I would say even more than that. I know this sounds meta, and I actually don't think it is. I think it's the movie. But the characters are trying very hard to be in a romantic film. And they're saying things that but the movie points this out constantly. Like his big line, which I fucking forgot, came from something in the movie where he says, "You complete me." Mm. And she basically cuts him off. Mm-hmm. He just ripped that off from a couple that was actually in love.
Yeah, right.
And so, and the movie tricks you because they do it in sign language. Yeah. And so they make it seem like it's
like
her
it was
idea.
Original. Yeah,
but
yeah.
No, he's fucking stealing some totally romantic idea.
And he even made a joke of it in the elevator. Yeah, he was like, I wonder what they're talking about, you know?
Yeah, yeah, totally. And so it's like, there's something weird that I want to try to explore, because it's so good, I don't believe any person could come up with it. Like that, like there's something so amazing about this movie.
It's perfect.
And it's more than perfect, because it's like, I've seen Cameron Crowe movies.
Yeah,
like
I
said, I've seen a lot of Cameron Crowe movies at this point.
Sure.
And if the guy who made Elizabethtown, which is basically, and it's true, the creation of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl. I mean, that's where the term comes from. Some reviewer said, this reminds me of a Manic Pixie Dream Girl. Maybe that's a trope. And they're like, this became a thing, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
He fucking invented Manic Pixie Dream Girl. And this is this could not be more the opposite of that. And so the truth and humanity of the woman that he creates in this film, even though she's certainly not noble or perfect, she's just human, I'm like, something fucking happened here.
I think this is what Cameron Crowe is good at. And other actors who aren't,
but he's horrible at this in other movies.
No, but I think he's doing something different. I think that when he goes for Grounded, this is what I'm driving.
How does someone know to subvert those traditions?
I don't know that he did it on purpose.
That's what I'm wondering.
Let me interject for one second. I'm not privy to Elizabethtown or what was the other one that he the other
Aloha.
Aloha, right? Yeah, I heard really bad things about that. But is it possibly not him so much as the chemistry between the actors?
Yes, big time. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's probably a big element of that. And I kept thinking of. This is not the same conversation necessarily, but I was thinking about Elizabethtown a lot. I mean, not that anybody has even seen
that. How
often
do you think about it?
Well, while I was watching this, and I was like, oh, Orlando Bloom is just no Tom Cruise.
Right.
Like, what are you going to do?
There's something about it, and I hate to keep harping on this, but I think it's the elevation of the performance. That for this to work, you have to fucking swing for the fences. And Tom Cruise is swinging for the fucking fences in this performance. And a lot of Cuba Gooding Jr. obviously is swinging for the fences in a way that doesn't feel unreal to me. I'm not at all slighting the performances. But you have to come swinging to make this work, and
because that brings the character's dignity, because that brings them truth, you know, which is that Tom Cruise thinks he's the hero and he's struggling and he's trying to be. I mean, like the scene. By the way, all to say, he couldn't be better in this movie.
Right.
No human being could be better than this because he like is the guy. Like as far as
he really is.
My watching this movie.
Everything he had done up until that point prepared him for that moment.
Yeah, perhaps so, but it's like, I feel like that all just goes away. Like, we said this stuff about Tom Cruise, you know, always bringing Tom Cruise, the movie star, and I think that's true in this movie, except that I also more than 100% believe that this is just Jerry Maguire, and that this guy is fragile, failure, self-obsessed narcissist.
Total.
Who doesn't know what he's
a
doing.
Liar, yeah.
The scene that I was sort of like, well, this is like one of the greatest performances I've ever seen, is where he overhears them talking in the kitchen. And so here's the scene. Mm-hmm. He's just slept with Renee Zellweger mm-hmm. after their first date, really. Yep. Their first and only date. He's already made an awkward pass at her, which is, you know, they both feel sort of embarrassed about. So now he asks her out on a real date. And they go out and they have a okay time, I guess. A pretty good time, it seems like. And she sort of idealizes him from afar. And, you know, that again, this is all pretty much shot from her point of view, this date scene, where she's standing far away looking at him. She comes out of her house and he's standing sort of glowing from a streetlight in the street. And it's like, oh, that's Prince Charming. There's my hero. Mm-hmm. He's not living up to this at all, though, really. He's like, we even sort of laughed. He does this thing in the restaurant. I'm getting off track, mm-hmm. but I'll get back to the point.
I did the same thing.
It's where okay. he's like, what? He's like telling some story and he's making ridiculous faces, mm-hmm. like at the table at the yeah. Mexican restaurant. And we're both like, that is like, what are you yeah. doing? It's the weirdest I've ever seen Tom Cruise look, honestly.
But I love seeing that because I don't see him do that
Me
anymore.
Too.
He doesn't do that.
So anyway, she brings him home. She's sort of like acting like, well, I don't know if this is such a good idea. My kid's asleep, but whatever. She can't help it. And mm-hmm. so they both decide to go in and sleep together. The next morning, she is making coffee, and Bonnie Hunt, her sister's there. It's Bonnie Hunt's house. That's who she's living with. And they're talking, and Bonnie Hunt's sort of doing this kind of, I'm trying to warn you, but also I realize you just had sex with this guy, and so that's a good night, and I don't want to ruin it or whatever. Very great and true performance. And they kind of fight, and it's kind of awkward. And then finally, Renee Zellweger softens and says, okay, well, there's one thing I want to tell you, and it's that I'm in love with him. And what we know during this is that Tom Cruise has stepped out of the bedroom, and he's in the hallway, and he can hear this entire conversation. So he can hear Bonnie Hunt kind of saying some negative stuff about him. Then he hears Renee Zellweger say she's in love with him. And then something happens where it's revealed that they discover that he's been listening the whole time, whatever. So he has to walk into that kitchen. And I was like, I don't know why, I was so in awe of Tom Cruise's playing mm-hmm. of this moment. Mm-hmm. He comes in and it's you're watching him front good guy, but also ego and cockiness. Mm-hmm. And like, I've just heard this great secret, but I'm going to play it cool. But he's also, he seems so pathetic to me. Like, yeah. he seems like he's walking into something he is so unqualified for
yeah.
and so out of his depth on, but he's trying to sort of just be the character that he yeah. thinks he's supposed to be.
Right.
It's amazing. I don't know how you do that.
Bonnie Hunt said, you know, hanging on by the bottom rung, he threw it right back at her. Said,
right, so he's trying to get one up. He's trying to say,
I'm
cool.
He hates being called a loser. That's his Achilles heel. He hates that.
Yeah, but okay. but I'm just seeing, like, this is a deeply and complexly yeah. human moment and
sure.
and I it but it doesn't do anything that you would think a movie would do. That's mm-hmm. I guess my point. And yet he does
I,
all of it
I said it during the movie. I don't see many scripts like this. In fact, it's hard to categorize, but as a romantic drama or whatever you want to call this, comedy dramedy, I just can't even think of it.
If you read this script, would you think it was good?
I would have no idea. I have no idea if I would. There
that's,
are certain
that's
things...
a tough call. I think structurally I would. I don't know. I think the writing's really good.
Everything fires. Like, it definitely structurally,
right.
it just everything pays off. Every
that's
word
right.
pays off.
I'll put
it's
it this
really
way.
Well,
great transition.
But something about it feels like I would think it was clawing on the page, but mm. on the screen.
Well,
even
as mm-hmm. like I was, this is so unfair, and I hate to even voice it this way, but I was imagining. When I mean that I don't think even Cameron Crowe is this good, I think he knows it. And I suspect that yeah. he's sitting in the editing. I kept having this vision of him sitting in the editing bay, putting yeah. his fucking soundtrack on, which is a nice soundtrack, but also his music is bullshit, sort of, in a certain way, in terms of its attempted manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
And
like
watching
that.
This
it's
thing and being
thing.
Like, oh, this is so much fucking better than I had any mm-hmm. reason to hope or believe. Like, mm-hmm. I think he just... It feels like the movie is...
Yeah.
stunned by itself.
Yeah.
Not in a self-celebratory way, but in a like, whoa, what have we done
Where
here?
Do you stand on Almost Famous? Do you not like it?
Not that good.
I was getting there.
Oh, it's okay, but it's not that good.
So this is the Cameron yeah. Crowe.
This is the best movie he's ever made.
I agree with you there.
By far.
100% okay. pinnacle of his career, but I am a fan of Almost Famous. Maybe I need to revisit it.
Well,
but I've seen it many
times. It wasn't bad, and it was actually, I watched it with Lily, and that was fascinating because she got into the kid... eye view of the
yeah.
fantasy fulfillment. It's yeah. just kind of fucked up about women, and it doesn't have this
oh, okay.
depth of self-awareness about that fucked upness,
yeah.
in my opinion. It's kind of weird.
I think the music works in this. I really do because there's a layer of awareness of the soundtrack.
Well, once in a while, Almost Famous does this too. There's a scene where the kid, who is the Cameron Crowe figure, has fallen in love with Penny Lane. And he winds up in this romantic gesture, very similar to this, and she's passed out on Quaaludes, basically overdosed. Mm-hmm. And he kisses her while holding her up while she's unconscious. And then, like, some medical people come in and they put her over the toilet and she's vomiting. Yeah. And Cameron Crowe, slow push in on the kid, turns up romantic music. And it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, but what if that's self-aware?
I think it might be. No, that moment, I think it might be. But the movie is just all to say it's not as good as this. It's fine. Yeah, it's fine. But it's not as good as this. And then other movies he's done do not do that. I can't say more strongly. They do not succeed at this kind of subversive use of anything. Well, and one more thing. Mm-hmm. One last thing. Then I'll just stop talking.
I just want to speak out the music, but go on.
The thing that this most reminds me of in the terms of its complexity of character and sitcom-y sort of liney sensibility is the producer's movie, who's James L. Brooks, who did Terms of Endearment and Broadcast News. And that's what this feels like, where they don't know how this movie's going to end. And because they didn't know when they started writing it, especially Broadcast News, the ending feels real weird.
Wait, sorry to interrupt. James L. Brooks was involved with this?
He produced this.
Yeah. Oh, well, that makes sense. And Broadcast News was one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah. Mm. And it's incredible writing. It's totally sloppy and weird and messy like this. But like, every character is deeply flawed, and none of them actually reach a self-awareness by the end of the film. And it just kind of ends, and it kind of goes in this weird direction. Mm. But that makes it, that's a good thing.
Sure.
And this movie felt a lot like that to me. Yeah. And so, anyway, maybe he had a hand in the development.
I think he for sure did.
Absolutely.
I do feel him on it. Like, 100%. When you watch this, you kind of see what's happening. Just in terms of the music real quick, here's a scene that I think the music plays multiple levels and does multiple things in each moment. And the example I'll use is when Tom Cruise is driving away, he's just had a good moment, he turns on the radio, he wants to sing along, it's not quite working, he goes to a different station, it's not quite working. And in the moment, what you feel is a guy looking to express what's inside of him and just find the right song and Free Fallin' by Tom Petty comes on, and boom, he's in it, and that's the scene you remember.
It was the right song for all of us watching that movie. When that song came on, we all were with him.
Yeah, and as a kid, that's the scene I remember. This time watching it, I felt something very different.
Yes.
Which was the guy looking for the right song that he's supposed to do in that moment.
That you're right, because that also is a super fucked up song to be celebrating singing based on this moment in time, you know, which is...
Right, but it works in both ways.
Well, it works in both ways. And what you just said, Evan, is very interesting to me, because... This is something that I tried to articulate at the beginning of this and failed, but it's something I'm very interested in, which is that we all felt that way. I think you're right. We, the three of us, all felt that way. Mm. But this movie doesn't... I would propose to you both, this movie does not get made today, and if it does, it gets raked across the coals for its white male subject. And I don't mean that. I don't mean like it shouldn't. It probably should, because it's really weird that movie speaks to a man who is just taking a leap, who is sort of in this free fall.
Yeah.
But it does not speak to almost anybody else. And what I was interested in is that what I had forgotten, really, kind of, is that the rest of the movie knows that. And it's sort of, I don't think the movie is aware of that it shouldn't be making a story about a white male, or that it's boring to make a story about a white male, especially someone in his 30s, especially someone who's rich. But the rest of the movie is also filled with characters who are observing that narcissism and privilege, I guess.
Well, absolutely. I think everyone around him, maybe other than Renee, who's smitten by him, experiences or... sees him from their perspective as being completely narcissistic and schmaltzy and ego driven and everything. I think they all get that. So I think it succeeds in that regard. They even what I love about it is they poke fun at Tom Cruise, Jerry Maguire, everything rolled up in one when they show his bachelor party video and they show him like cockily, you know, being like, "I love you too. I love you too." You know, that agent move. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's so great, because you see the cracks in his armor, and that's really important with a character that he's been playing forever. And now this one is like the destruction and rebuilding of
that. That's really smart, you know? Man. And with the movie...
I love that.
That's smart. And I think that what the movie does structurally is really smart. The movie starts with a 5 to 7 minute voiceover by Tom Cruise about this manifesto he's writing. And what that does is it allows for the rest of the film for Renee Zellweger and Tom Cruise to chase a version of him that does not exist.
Yes.
And that is really smart, structurally.
Yes. Okay, so what you just said there, I also want to say earlier, in that scene that you loved in the kitchen with the sister, when she says, I'm in love with the man that he
almost
will be. Will be. So she basically is in love with the image, the projection of what she thinks that he could be, you know? And that made me question her side of things as well. Like, does she really love him, or is she just in love with the projection of who he could be, the potential of who he is?
Yes, which is
she fell in love with his manifesto in the very beginning. She knew the paragraphs of it by heart.
And the movie slowly driving them toward the conclusion that that's not a real guy.
Exactly. Yeah,
period.
And he doesn't even want to be that guy. And the more you think about that manifesto, when he walks out of the elevator, he tries to get back. He realizes this isn't me.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm not that guy who wrote that thing.
He wrote it at 2 a.m, instant nirvana, where all this bullshit in LA that we all try to achieve.
Right.
Instant nirvana. One night of like, oh, I reached it, you know, myself.
And the movie's so smart that it makes him print it and drop it off in that moment. Yeah. I mean, it really is. They're chasing a specter the whole movie that doesn't exist. But, you know, you never doubt Renee Zellweger's sincerity, because she is the kind of woman who would chase that specter. And it gives her strength to walk away from it.
I don't fault her for it. I'm not judging
her. I think that's really clever that the movie gives her the strength to walk away from it.
Her moment of clarity where she can look through all that but that scene's amazing too, because that, again, I don't want to over harp on this, but Tom Cruise's performance there kills me, because he doesn't know what she's talking about. He's like totally bewildered and lost. And he's like, I think
that's such a well
so many times
scene.
It is. And so many times, even in the scene where the multiple scenes where he watches Cuba Gooding Jr. and his wife be romantic together and have a true connection, he has no idea how to access that. And that it's a very delicate and fascinating character portrait of somebody who can't get there.
You know what's great though about that is that, by definition, a sports agent is someone who sits on the sidelines watching other people live a life.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So that's the core metaphor I bet he sort of built from in a way when he's right thinking about this.
Right.
But there's so many scenes of Tom Cruise on the outskirts of a circle of people having a moment and him watching it.
Yeah.
And it's almost like that's how he lives his entire life.
Living vicariously through their... Yeah.
And again, the movie knows all this because it keeps setting up these scenes where he is supposed to express some insight or have some self-awareness. Like, there's this another awesome scene where they're lying, he's come home from some game or whatever after being away for a long time, and Renee Zellweger is climbing into bed with him, and they have this very awkward and interesting human conversation about whether she's like, I don't know your noises yet. She's like, sometimes I don't think I know what you're thinking, and like, I'm not getting it. And he says, well, next time you want to know, just ask me. And she says, oh yeah, okay, cool, I think I just did. He doesn't know what he's thinking. He doesn't know who he is. He has nothing to offer. He can't even answer that question.
I do love that the scene you're talking about previous to this, where she says, listen, we both know this is a mistake. We've rushed into this. Mm-hmm. We both know this isn't a real thing. And the audience is like, yeah, we're with you. We agree. Like, you're saying something true and bold and brave, and we like this. Mm-hmm. And Tom Cruise's response is to say, I don't run away from this. I'm not a quitter.
Yeah.
Which is him not understanding what the fuck she's talking about. But it's a trope of what a man would say
exactly
in the moment. It's the thing a man should say. He knows enough to go, well, I know what to say here. I don't quit. I don't fucking turn and run.
Especially a romantic comedy hero. especially.
What I like about the film is the honesty and rawness of not quite knowing whether the people in his life who have dated him in the past, maybe they're right about him. Maybe he can't be alone. Maybe that's why he is with her. Maybe it isn't because they're really in love. I like that there's a question. I like that maybe he really is a liar and he hasn't really come to the truth of the situation.
Yeah, there's a horror to the fact that he thinks everyone else knows me better than I do.
Right.
Everybody else. And,
exactly.
And he can't access. He doesn't know how to get there. He doesn't know how to see. Or if he doesn't want to see that version. And also, that's not a complete person. That's a fucking... joke is a cliche, basically. And so he's trying very hard not to be a cliche, but, you know, how do you pull yourself out of that? How do you become a real person?
I think this is a great movie for the podcast. I think I see it in a very different way than I saw it the first time I saw it. I really am having a moment where I'm thinking about the tragedy of this film in a way that the emotional happiness of it, it was the first thing I saw. I remember it being very empowering, very emotional, and it was certainly all those things for me. Now I welled up a couple times. I really felt the emotion of the film, and yet there's some deeply tragic undercurrent to this film this time that
it,
I didn't catch.
Well, we all saw it before our careers have taken off in our lives. I saw it at what, 17-18 years old?
Yeah.
So I saw it at a point where I hadn't experienced yet the bullshit and insincerity of this business that I'm in, that I've confront on a regular basis, and confronted myself too, that shallowness that we're talking about, and I question why I am still in it, and I try to find that joy again constantly. I'm always searching for that joy, so I think it absolutely has a resonancy. Is that the word, resonance with me. You just say resonance. You don't say residency. Because residency would be like, yeah, sure.
Yeah,
sometimes I have trouble with words. I think it's just stuck with me for that reason, because it does have different meaning for me today.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think this... Yeah. I didn't expect it to have that. Is kind of
well. It fascinates. I mean, on that same front, you know, this is one of those movies that I am fascinated by in terms of it being a mainstream hit. I'm like, everybody must have been watching this. The only way this movie's a hit is that they watch the romantic comedy version of it.
And there's a subversive undercurrent. There's an underbelly to this film.
And I can't believe it's been there the whole time. This isn't a case of like what I think I was setting up in the intro, and what I had sort of mistaken about my response is that I thought I was doing an alt read. I'm convinced that's the read. I mean, we can all debate that, but like, I think everything I'm saying about the film is right there on screen. And yet everybody, in order to embrace it as a mass culture, could not have been responding to that. I just can't believe it.
Well, I think one of the other crowning achievements of the film, which it might have been around the same time as Usual Suspects and Sixth Sense, is that it really, really wins you over in the end. Like, it totally has a payoff. It
gives you
Little Miss Sunshine is a payoff. And throughout all those films, at least I would argue, that they all have some moments where you're like, when is this over? Even Usual Suspects, even Sixth Sense. But then in the end, it absolutely wins you over. This movie won me over with two things. The football scene with Rod Tidwell, which was surprising. Like, I maybe had a sense that he was going to get injured. I guess there was some foreboding mentions of that. But I don't know. It just got me. And then the scene where he walks into the women's group, did not expect that to play out that way, and it did, and it was really well written.
It gives you the emotional punch of the meaningfulness of it, while still not betraying the reality of the characters' in base insincerity and incompleteness.
Like, yeah, and I mean, as far as my read of it, you know, that what I was amazed by, and this is, it's not to discount the emotions and the experience that you had, but watching that divorce group scene at the end, I was at that point, I wasn't very emotional. I was sad. I was disappointed. Yeah. You know, and again, the movie's right there for that.
Oh, so tell me why you were disappointed.
Well, because I just see them falling into a cycle.
She shouldn't be.
They've done this before.
Many people would side with you and agree with you there. I am fine having my emotions end with their emotions and not concerning myself with the future.
I think that's fine.
But a lot of people have concerned themselves with the future, like you are saying, and I just choose not to think about
that. Well, I think that's what they're doing. So that's totally makes sense. It's sort of points of identification.
Yeah.
And again, the movie's genius about giving you multiple points of identification because once again, like, they haven't forgotten about the Bonnie Hunt character who's there looking disappointed. Yeah. She's just there watching this.
The performance by Bonnie Hunt when she says "I love him" is an amazing moment. She looks so sad in that moment, so disappointed. Yeah. It's really a great moment.
Once in a while, the movie caves for jokes. Like, it does weird like cutaway jokes, which are sitcom-y. And James L. Brooks does this too. But in this one, they didn't break the spell for me, but they were glimpses of a different version of the film.
Did you not think the women's group at the end, like the women in the group, do you think some of them might have been maybe not 100% sold, but have turned their opinion around about him or men in general?
I don't know that I buy this idea that they were all sort of super anti-man. I mean, I think that they're Renee Zellweger's read on them is probably the most typical sort of audience read. I saw them all as just sort of hurt people.
Sure.
And so I don't think that they're necessarily about to stand up and applaud this moment. I think that they're won over by loneliness, or they're swayed by the absence of loneliness that these two people are
getting
together.
But do you think they were moved by this moment, maybe?
Sure.
Yeah.
Renee Zellweger's performance is really stunning to me, and I just want to talk about that and Cuba Gooding Jr.'s performance for a second.
Yeah.
But this. So Renee Zellweger is playing this woman who was, by her own admission, married to a not that nice man who passed away and left her with a child. And she loves her son very much. Mm-hmm. And she has had sporadic, if any, sexual encounters. Right. I think three over the last 4 years is what she says. And then, and she's also not that rich, not that powerful, and is staying at her sister's house. She's clearly broke. She quits her job as an accountant, which is a shitty job, in this big, massive firm. She's a cog in a machine. And then the guy we see her idolize on the plane at the very beginning of the film, it's Tom fucking Cruise, comes and says, "I like you." And there's this moment where he's making out with her and kissing her neck on the porch, and her eyes are, it's a beautiful performance. Yeah. She's like, "What the fuck is happening to me? Why is Tom Cruise kissing my neck?" And you feel Tom Cruise is kissing my neck. And you see this performance in her. And I think it's such an amazing thing, because that is the type of character who would chase this dream, no matter how silly it seems in the moment. Because it is what she wanted. On paper, and the image of that is what she wanted. The mission statement version of Tom Cruise is what she wants, and that joy and that, you know, unbelievable look she has on her face right there says it. And it to me, it sells the rest of the film. Of course, she chases that dream. She has to.
Yeah.
Well, and once again, I find it so funny and so odd that Renee Zellweger became this America's sweetheart character because of the depth and nuance of this. She's not a fantasy. Who do they? What movie star do they compare her to when she comes out in the dress?
Audrey Hepburn.
Audrey Hepburn. She's not Audrey Hepburn.
Not at all.
And so I was thinking of her career ever since. Like, it's funny that the world idealized her in that way. Mm-hmm. I think because she's playing something much more real.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they fell in love with every woman.
They obviously fell in love with that feeling she's expressing of, "I can't believe this is happening to me." That's a very delightful Hollywood story.
He was
story.
Referring to her superficially as looking in that moment like an Audrey Hepburn movie.
No, I know. I think the movie is aware of all that.
There was no depth to that. There was no real meaning.
But the way that the world reacted to this film and the way that they embraced Renee Zellweger as America's sweetheart, it was this crazy thing where she was suddenly toast of Hollywood. Yeah.
Sure.
And they wanted her to be this ingenue going forward until she kind of stopped.
What did she do immediately after? I forgot.
Bridget Jones came soon.
Of course.
And then she did Chicago later on. And Chicago, Bridget Jones, I think she's great in. Chicago's not quite the role for her, in my opinion.
Well, she's good. She was nominated for Cold Mountain, and she's pretty awesome in that. But eventually, she wasn't, again, she's like...
But Cold Mountain's not the ingenue part.
That's no,
part
not at all.
Yeah.
That's the one that I think they were sort of trying to break her out of, or she
Which
was trying to break herself
That's
out of that
she
mold.
Is
and I think I assume she continues to try to do that. But this is seeing this performance, it's an illogical role to cast her in for the world. But I get why they did it.
In the movie, it's perfect casting.
The movie's amazing. Agree. Yeah.
Love her.
She stole my heart in this movie.
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, totally fair. Tell me about Cuba Gooding Jr. Evan, what do you think about him? What do you think about Cuba Gooding Jr.?
You know, it just occurred to me that I've been doing my impression for a long time, and I do this thing where I go, "Woo!" You know, like I always do that.
Yeah.
And I think I take it from Cuba more than Tom. I think that's where I draw that, because I know that Tom does that too, but Cuba does it at the end of the movie a few times when he's being interviewed and saying, "Don't make me cry, don't make me cry."
You're right.
He does it twice, and I do it exactly like he does it. So I think subconsciously I've drawn my inspiration from him.
That's funny. Correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of the lines you did at the beginning were almost all from this movie.
Yeah, they were.
Are they all from this movie?
Oh, most of them were. I did segue into...
You did
what I do.
Magnolia.
I did Magnolia.
The cloaked
and
failure line
Risky
is
business.
Incredible.
Right.
Sometimes
right.
you just got to say, "What the fuck, make your move," you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The cloaked and failure line is the best.
That's amazing.
You see this jacket I'm wearing? You see this coat I'm wearing? I don't need to wear them because I'm cloaked in failure. It's so funny. It's hysterical.
Right.
Because that scene was just written so well, because it really was like him at the bottom, like in hell, like nightmarish. Like he's just so desperate.
I bet you're drawn to this because it's Tom Cruise amped to a 10. And Tom Cruise is always amped
to a
10.
It's amped to a 10, but it's also Tom Cruise fighting his way back from nothing and winning.
Mm.
And it gets me for that reason that it's totally aspirational. I think that's the biggest thing, you know, just like Entourage is aspirational for every male in America, I guess.
Sure.
That's so interesting that you say that in terms of there's a movie star trope. There's this film, this Philip K. Dick book that we've been sort of trying to make for a long time.
Yeah.
And the concept of it basically is the world's biggest TV star suddenly passes into an alternate reality where he's not famous.
Mm.
And it's fucking movie star bait because they all indulge in this fantasy and you need a famous person to play that part, but they are fascinated by the idea of losing it all and being nobody.
So in this alternate reality, so no one cares about
them. They don't even know who he is. And it's just totally blowing his
mind.
I love it. And the book goes on from there. But like, it's so funny to me that like these actors, male actors, are like, they all want to play that part, you know? And I think it's part of this same kind of idea is that like, what if... rich old me became like on his back on his heels or whatever
the script
and that's a very fascinating fantasy for somebody who's rich and famous to play out, and this one, you know, flirts with it, but it's not the story of like a homeless person. It's someone trying to climb their way back up. However, again, I think this movie is constantly subverting that track and says
what's that story called
Flow My Tears, the policeman said.
Okay, I love classic, the titles of
classic
his
Dick
stories.
awesome. So anyway, go see it, guys. It's in theaters now.
Oh, and I totally forgot to mention my website is not tomcruise.com.
Oh,
my whole brand.
Let's segue here.
Oh, yeah.
Give us everything. Give us all.
Well, that's all. I mean, I don't even do the social thing that much. I just have a website. People can book me through that. It's nottomcruise.com, and it has my trailer. I've done hundreds of videos, you know, with YouTube and whatever. And I don't really have like a big Instagram following or anything like that. Plug it. But it's just Not Tom Cruise Official. I only have that because it's Not Tom Cruise was taken for some reason.
Who took Not Tom Cruise?
Maybe it's my rival in person.
That motherfucker. We got to get this guy. Off air, you got to tell us two stories. The other one teased us with before. And then two, who this guy is, and we're going to go take care of him.
I hope he's gotten over this thing, but
Not Tom Cruise Official Army.
Tom Cruise Official at Instagram. www.nottomcruise.com.
That's it.
Please go check him out, guys. Evan Ferrante, he's incredible. You got a taste of it now, but it's awesome. His videos are incredible.
Evan, do you know the sort of speech that he gives when he comes back to Renee Zellweger? Do you know those lines?
In fact, I'm doing it on the 8th at the El Rey Theater for the Orthodox Jewish community.
Plug it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Plug it. Can we pretend to be Orthodox?
It's an event at the Chai Center, at the El Rey Theater on the 8th. I don't know if it's open to the public. I really don't know. Okay. If it is, you can check it out. El Rey Theater, the 8th. Yeah. I don't know.
Guys, go see
it. I bring it up because I only just wanted to test your performance chops. What I wanted to do is to say, how good are you if you have to pretend Travis is Renee Zellweger?
Fine.
This will take us out.
Okay. I might not look. I mean, look, the audience doesn't know what I'm doing. I could be naked in this room right now.
I'm going to close my eyes.
But I'm just going to do this for a second.
Standing up, you guys.
Ready?
Okay.
I'm looking for my wife. Wait. If this is where it has to happen, then this is where it has to happen. You know, this used to be my thing. They used to send me in here and I just go in alone. But now, just tonight, our company, our little project, had a very big night. Very big. But it wasn't complete. It wasn't even close to being in the same vicinity as complete. Because I couldn't share with you. I couldn't hear the sound of your voice or see you smile. I miss my wife. We live in a cynical world. A cynical world. And we work in a business full of tough competitors. I love you. You complete me. You. Come on. You're one line.
You had me at hello.
It's shut up. You had me at hello. But yeah, that's it.
We'll see you next time. Oh, fine. Forgot that we had to pull a movie. Yeah, God, I was ready to just go.
That was incredible.
How did we top it?
I mean, I'm blushing. I'm sweating. Look at
I did make eye contact with you a few times.
Guys, look at my face. It's bright red. I'm really hot.
You're right. It is a romantic moment. Yeah. I was wrong. There's nothing subversive about
like
that.
It's like when you're on the other end of a laser cannon, man.
Jesus Christ, Evan.
All right, going through.
Next week, guys.
Next week we have...
On Does Your Favorite Movie Suck?
Here we go. Ready?
Yes.
Pull a good one.
I'm saying.
Yeah.
Oh, this is one of my favorites. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Hey! Love it!
All-time favorites.
See us next time.
I hope that holds up.
Hear us next time for Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you, Evan. You were amazing.
Thank you for doing this.
See you around.
Sure.